That's a problem, but it's not our problem. The teasing half-smile lifted his face again. But he has much more reason to deny it than I do to invent it.
He shrugged. Maybe.
I was irritated. Well, of course he does. Why would I want to make all this trouble for myself if it weren't true?
Well, it's trouble for you, but it's trouble for him, too, isn't it?
Well, why would I want to make trouble for him, then? I could hear that I was beginning to sound frazzled.
He lifted his hand. You tell me.
There isn't any reason. In a way, I barely know the man. I have no axe to grind here.
Maybe you do, maybe you don't.
I don't. I assure you, I don't. Why on earth would I want to put anyone through this unless it was true? What kind of monster of ill will would I have to be to do such a thing?
It would be ill will, all right.
He sounded almost amused. But I have no such ill will. I have no reason for it. He let a little silence accumulate between us before he said,
Tell me something.
Of course, I said.
Were you ever, like, attracted to Dr. Mayhew, Mrs. Becker?
And suddenly, it was clear to me what Eli had said, how he defended himself. And even in that moment of clarity, with its accompanying sense of danger, I was aware also of being pettily annoyed, of wanting to say, Look, I'm the doctor, he's the mister. For a moment, I was speechless, but finally I said, Is that what he told you?
Well, you know, we wondered too, so we asked him why he thought you would go to all this trouble. It was an idea he had, let's say.
I shook my head, it's not true.
So you were not attracted to him?
Detective Lewis had blue eyes, bright blue below the heavy eyebrows, and they were steady on me now as he waited. I was attracted to him, but I didn't seek revenge on account of it.
But you were attracted.
I had been, yes.
Were you disappointed in your attraction?
He was smirking, his lips tight over the big teeth. How elegantly you put it, I said. No, I wasn't. My attraction ended when Mr. Mayhew confessed to me, when he told me he'd murdered my friend.
So you weren't pissed off at him that he didn't respond to you?
Not by that time, no, I shook my head. After a pause, he said,
Did you ask him to meet you at the Ritz Hotel? Did you call him?
That is true, but
so you were still attracted to him at that point, at the point at which you called him. Why are you talking to me this way?
My voice was shrill.
I'm not accused of anything. Well, you are, kind of. You made some serious charges against Dr. Mayhew, and it's possible you did that vindictively.
I didn't. He was still looking at me, and I thought suddenly of how he must see me. Old, desperate, disappointed. I had dressed drably, I realized now. I supposed to seem responsible and reliable to Detective Ryan. This guy would be seeing it another way. He shifted now in his chair.
What were your expectations, Mrs. Becker, when you went to the Ritz Hotel to meet Dr. Mayhew?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I shook my head.
But maybe one possibility was beginning a relationship with him. Maybe?
I didn't answer. He sat back.
Why did you choose a hotel, Mrs. Becker? You chose it. Am I right? You suggested it?
It's a famous bar. I don't know Boston that well. I chose the Ritz bar.
There was no notion in your mind that Dr. Mayhew might spend the night with you.
Look, Detective Lewis, I burst out. Having lascivious thoughts is one thing, and making up a terrible lie about someone else is another thing. And I didn't make this up.
Hey, Mrs. Becker, this isn't even my case.
His big hands rose.
All I'm saying here is we ended up with two people with profoundly different versions of what went on and why, and our job is to sort out plausibilities. If there'd been one thing that made your story more plausible, we would have gone ahead, but there was nothing, and it flies in the face of some of the evidence we do have. What? What evidence? He had an alibi. Did you know that?
Lewis was slouched now. He was enjoying this, I saw.
Every one of you had an alibi, someone who would vouch for you. In his case, someone in his lab who saw him at just about that time. And he had test results coming in that he recorded over that whole period.
I shook my head. I hadn't known. How could Eli have arranged it? Half-lit scenarios began to play in my mind, but even as I started to construct them, I knew that to offer them up would be to seem more desperate, defensive. I knew it would be useless.
"And then there's the money," he said.
What I thought of instantly was the money I'd kept in my drawer, which I'd had to explain then several times, my unusual system of banking, one of the cops had called it. I must have looked confused or blank because he said, "Money was stolen, if you remember. I think you must have forgotten that." I saw it then, the cop coming back in from the backyard, carrying the plastic bag, the red and green Medaglia d'Oro can in it, empty. Larry, Sarah nodding. Yes, that was it. I cleared my throat. But it would have been the easiest thing in the world for Eli to take that to cover up for himself.
Did he tell you he took it?
No.
But he was so candid with you about other things.
He couldn't keep the sarcasm from his voice.
I can't believe he wouldn't have explained that, too.
After a long moment, he shook his head. He was smiling again.
I don't think so, Mrs. Becker. See, it just doesn't pull the pieces together.
I'm sure I looked defeated, done in. His voice, when he spoke again, was not unkind.
Look, what I can tell you is that we still think your friend's murder was a break-in that went bad. And we still think maybe someone will talk about it, maybe even someone in jail for something else. Though, as time passes, and we know this too, it gets less likely. What we don't think is that Dr. Mayhew was involved. That's what I can tell you.
I was silent, looking out of the window at the pale sky. Then I said, "So you think I'm a pathological liar?" He smiled once more, that false vulpine smile, his head tilted.
"Just out of curiosity, Mrs. Becker," he said pleasantly. "Why the fake ID back then? All the lies to your roommates."
And when I didn't answer,
"Hey," he said, "we checked it out. We called him. He came in more than once. We poked around. You can't ask for more than that."
He lifted his hands.
"I guess not,"
I said at last. My voice was small.
"So," he said, pushing his chair back, "that about takes care of it, I guess."
"Yes," I said.
"Yes, I guess it does."
I was trembling with a kind of rage, I think, as I walked back to the car, and when I got there, I sat for a while, turned sideways in the driver's seat, my feet on the ground still, light-headed in a way that made me feel I might at any moment throw up. When it passed, I was slowly aware of a pure relief, a relief so intense that I gradually began to feel nearly giddy. It was over. That's what I was thinking. It was finished. I had acted. I had done the right thing as I saw it, dreading what it might lead to. And it had led to nothing, to air and freedom, to my life coming back to me. I could begin again. I started the car. I drove across Cambridge toward Route 2. I was going down Brattle Street, between the rows of widespread, splendid houses, the vast yards opening on either side of me. I was thinking again of Dana, as I so often had in these weeks and months, but this time with such ease and familiarity that it seemed I could hear her hoarse, ugly voice speaking to me. Sudden tears spilled from my eyes. I signaled and pulled over to park. When I had gained control of myself and could see clearly again, I looked around. A fence ran along the edge of the sidewalk next to me. It was made of tall, solid spikes, square, their white paint gently peeling here and there. The ground posts that interrupted their progress every 10 feet or so were topped with elaborate and improbable wooden urns. The yard behind the fence swept up to a Georgian house. It was grey with black listing shutters. In front of it, an elderly woman. At first I thought her a man, but then I saw the wisps of hair drooping down from under her cloth hat. Was slowly, nearly ceremonially, clipping branches from a large, scraggly shrub. Forsythia. Forcing, I supposed. Or perhaps she was just pruning. In any case, I thought of it as such an enviable occupation. She was so absorbed in it, so engaged, that I felt a rush of odd elation. It seemed to me possible that I could peacefully come to be that old, that I would have my everyday chores to do, that I might do them in the pale sunlight of early spring. I was released to this, I thought. I was back in ordinary time. What did it matter what Eli had accused me of? The people who believed it, Detective Lewis, Detective Ryan, even Jean, were people I didn't care about. Of course, I cared about Sadie, but Sadie hadn't heard every ugly twist. She hadn't heard the worst of it. And she and I had time, all the time in the world, I thought. I started the car. I drove on again. I stopped in the big supermarket on the highway between Adams Mills and Shirley and did a thorough shopping for what seemed like the first time in months. In every wide aisle there was something I could use, and it was with a sense of nearly physical pleasure that I pushed my cart up and down the sections and slowly filled it. The abundance of ordinary things, their convenient arrangement here, seemed for the moment a personal gift to me, as did my ability to notice this, to be grateful for it. At home, I went in and out many times, hauling all the bags. The dogs were happy to follow me, each trip an adventure, the more the better. They nosed at the bags, they chased each other off, barking wildly in pleasure. Their life returning to them, too. They continued to argue and chase each other around the kitchen as I put things away, as if they could sense the change in the air, the change in me. I'd bought ingredients for risotto for dinner, and when I was through putting the food away, I'd chopped the shallots and mushrooms. I set the broth out in a pan, measured the rice, poured the olive oil into the heavy enameled skillet. I set the table. I washed lettuce and made a dressing for salad. I imagined us sitting at the table talking. But if things were still stiff with Daniel, if he didn't want to talk, that was all right too. I had time there also. Time and Daniel's nature, which was forgiving, which was generous. I remembered that when I'd been so overwhelmed by my feelings for Eric, our clinic assistant. Daniel had wept with me and held me, as though my being tempted were a thing, an event, that had happened to us both, causing us both pain, which we would suffer through together. There was still a faint light hovering in the yard when he drove in, though I'd turned the lights on inside a while earlier. The dogs whined and ran to the back hall to wait for him. I could hear his voice as he spoke to them in greeting, light, loving. I felt the cold air drifting in. And then he stood in the doorway and nodded, a half smile, polite and obligatory on his face. "Hi," I said. I'd tossed the shallots into the olive oil when I saw him pull in, and now I was stirring them. They hissed. "Hi," he answered. He stepped toward me and stopped part way across the room. I had turned sideways to greet him as I worked, and now he noticed what I was doing. "Hey, what's for dinner?" he asked, and he was unable to keep the lift from his voice. "Risotto." "Risotto." And it was only then that I remembered the first time I'd made risotto for him, just after news of its culinary chic had reached our corner of the universe. It was a weekend night and Sadie was out, or I would never have tried it. Daniel was dubious. "You can call it risotto, but it sure looks like rice to me," he said, putting on a tough guy voice.
Ah, he had said with the first bite. Very soothing.
And with the second.
Wonderful. Like baby food for adults. Thank you for making it.
He'd been in and out of the kitchen as I cooked. He'd seen how long it took. Now he leaned over the table and kissed me, a kiss that expanded slightly and startled us both. We sat back, and he looked at me with the slightly stupid gaze of someone in the throes of a sexual impulse.
In fact, he had said, I think what I would like here is for you to feed me.
I laughed, but then I picked up his spoon and lifted it to his opening mouth. Surely I must have been thinking of that when I bought the rice. Must have been recollecting some part of it, the half-eaten dinner, the eager stumbling across the living room, the dogs whining outside the bedroom door at the noises we made, at this inexplicable interruption in the meal, their favorite human activity of the day. Now he started toward the living room.
Well, let me freshen up, as they say.
And he went out the door. And then he reappeared. He'd remembered.
Hey, what happened with the police?
Well, there's some good news and some bad news, I said, stirring the pan. I'll tell you when you come back. He'd pulled on a sweater when he returned. He asked if I wanted some wine, and I said yes. He opened a bottle and poured us each a glass. As he held mine out to me, our eyes met, and there seemed to me for the first time in weeks to be an openness in his gaze, a willingness to see me, to see who I was.
Well, he said, here's to the good news, whatever it may be. We need it.
Indeed, I said, and lifted my glass to him, too, before I drank. I set it down. I added more broth to the risotto. Daniel went to the table, pulled a chair out, and sat down. Allie came and sat between his opened legs, resting her muzzle on his thigh. He stroked her head. He looked up at me, watching him.
Tell me, he said. Tell me.
My heart leapt. It was like being touched. I smiled at him.
Well, it's over, essentially, I said.
He looked confused for a few seconds, and then he said, they're not going to pursue it? I shook my head, nope.
But how come?
'Cause he denied it.
I guess I knew he would, especially after Sadie called, but anyway, he did. Never happened.
So that's it.
I nodded.
God. That's a relief. He drank and set his glass down. One hand rested, gripping the stem, and he twirled it for a moment. He looked at me and frowned. Still, I would have thought they'd somehow at least investigated anyway. I shrugged, stirring.
There wasn't really anything to investigate. No new evidence or anything like that, and there's still stuff that's not explained by what he told me. I mean, as they pointed out, I didn't come in there and solve it for them, so...
So, in effect, they said there was nothing they could do?
More or less.
Well, that surprises me somehow, I guess.
Well, it ended up being my word against his, pretty much.
So? He sipped his wine again, and I stopped stirring to sip mine. I mean, he's the one with the reason to lie. Doesn't that give it a little weight, your account?
One might have thought so. One would have been wrong, I guess.
I'm insulted on your behalf, madam. He was almost smiling.
It was like the dawn breaking for me.
I smiled back and curtsied quickly.
Thank you, I said. But it is the insult that sets us free of it.
I suppose. So how did they present it? Just... Very sorry, we can't proceed on this basis. I turned away to add more broth to the risotto. After a moment, I said,
Well, they weren't quite that pleasant about it.
What do you mean? I adjusted the temperature down a bit.
Joe, he said,
Well, Eli had offered them a reason why I might not be truthful. Which was? There was an impatience, the beginning of indignation in his voice. Which was? I looked up at him. This, by the way, is the bad news, Daniel. I tried to keep my voice light, which was that I had been angry at him, at Eli, because he disappointed me. I tried to make the word sound comical. I made a face. He disappointed you? Yes. He looked quizzically at me, the one sharp frown line between his brows. Sexually, I explained, because he didn't want an affair and I did. This is what he told them. So you accuse him of murder? I mean, people get disappointed all the time without that happening. Well, he made me seem very aggressive, I think. Maybe he said I'd been in love with him in the past, too. I don't know. I'm sure he elaborated. I set the spoon down and turned to face him, to tell him everything. And they knew that I'd called him, that I'd chosen the Ritz. The point there being that it's a hotel, not just a bar. Convenient, you see.
I see.
He looked down at Allie's head still resting on his leg. He scratched her ears contemplatively. I went back to work, but I watched him too. He looked up finally.
You were the one who called him then, he said.
Yes.
And you did choose the Ritz?
Yes.
Because it was a hotel?
I think I thought of that, yes.
And were you disappointed then?
His eyes were so dark suddenly. Can the pupil expand in pain, in anger, that I couldn't read his face? What I was disappointed about, Daniel, was who he turned out to be, what he'd done, that superseded everything once he told me. He looked down again. His hand was motionless on the dog's head. Now he removed it. He sat frozen for some long seconds. Daniel, I said. He didn't look at me. I'd stopped stirring. I told you this. I told you all of this, Daniel. We don't have to do it again. This is nothing new. My voice was pleading. At last, he said,
no.
He sounded as he'd sounded for weeks until tonight, until his ease earlier tonight, exhausted. He seemed smaller, abruptly caved in.
Though I didn't know. And I heard him trying for a dry tone, a rueful distance. I didn't quite know, did I? That you were the aggressor, the arranger, the one who chose the Ritz.
His voice italicized it.
I thought briefly, rejecting it nearly as fast as the thought came, of defending myself on the tiny bit of territory left to defend. Eli had called first, had asked me out first, had invited and was waiting for my call. Rejecting it because it made no difference, really. Because it wasn't an important distinction in the end. Because I'd seen move across Daniel's face when he realized why the police didn't believe me, the shadow of doubt about it, too, the momentary possibility that he didn't know me at all, that I was the person they thought I was, the person Eli had said I was, who invented it all, who lashed out, who lied because she was disappointed. And in spite of my horror at seeing it, I felt such hungry, pathetic gratitude when it passed that there was no struggle, no pride left in me. And so I answered him finally. I said, no. No, you didn't.
Chapter 15. There was, of course, the rest of life going on at the same time. Things to do, things to respond to. Nora won a grant to finish her film, and in celebration, she cut her hair off. I can't imagine it, I said on the phone. What do you look like?
Well,
Here's the thing. She gave a snorting laugh. The joke was on her. Of course. I look like Cass.
After a pause, visualizing it, a fuller, rounder Cass, I said,
Well, isn't that what we all want to look like, a rock and roll star?
Now she laughed fully.
Yeah, I suppose so. Except get with it, Mother. They don't call it rock and roll anymore.
And one day in early March, I was putting some things away in the attic when I found an envelope I'd left there in the fall. I recognized it immediately. It held a copy of a picture Beatty had taken of me at work, a picture of me that was, for a change, very good. I'd had it blown up, planning to give it to Daniel for Christmas. But I'd forgotten. In my distraction about Eli, I'd forgotten it was here. I sat on a trunk now and opened it. Beatty had spoken to me as I was putting a file away. I just lifted my head to her, my hair still falling slightly forward, and I was beginning to laugh at the animal snout she wore on her face, a pig's, when she snapped me. Looking at it now, and my happy, smiling face in another world, the gift I would have given to Daniel, I could have wept. Spring arrived once for 2 days. I left the back door open, and the dogs trailed freely in and out, tracking mud into the kitchen. I sat in the thin sunlight on the back stoop and watched them, imagining an end to winter, an end to our terrible time. The next day, of course, there was a freezing rain. I couldn't unlock my car door and had to call Beatty, whose car spent its nights in a garage, to come and pick me up. Sadie wrote us a postcard, saying she wouldn't be home for spring break, that she was going to New York, to be with my sisters, as though these were people with no connection to us. Daniel went away to Philadelphia for 4 days for church meetings. In his absence, I felt such a lifting off of sorrow, of my oppressive sense of guilt, that I began to wonder if perhaps it might not be better for both of us to live without this strain, to separate, to divorce. It made my heart pound unevenly to think of it, but I forced myself to. For surely he, too, was more himself at work or out in his study. Surely he, too, was happier in those moments when he'd forgotten my existence. I imagined a life alone in some small apartment. I'd leave Daniel the house, of course. I imagined the ease of solitude, of meals eaten standing up, or while I lay on a couch reading, of not having to notice always what I was saying, how he was reacting, or what he was saying, how I was reacting. But then he returned, and our life went on. 3 days gone, a week. I measured the time in the faint waning of my consciousness of my misery, and wondered if this would one day be enough, simply not to be consciously miserable anymore. In early April, about 10 days after Daniel came back, my mother fell. What she broke was her foot, not the dreaded hip, but she'd be on crutches for at least a month. I took a week off from work to go up to Maine and help her. Daniel drove me to the airport. One of Mother's boarding students would borrow her old Buick and pick me up in Bangor. We were as polite and careful with each other as usual on the drive into Boston. I commented on the yellowing sweeps of the willows, on the odd batches of crocus or squill here and there. Daniel smiled or nodded, and in turn told me about the resolution of a crisis they'd been having at church, a kind of political struggle over deacons. For a while, I closed my eyes and rested. Let him think I was sleeping if he wanted to. As we drove through the city, though, slowing, stopping, starting, I sat up looking around. We were entering the airport. Suddenly Daniel said, It'll be good for us, this time apart. I looked at him. We just had time apart when you were in Philadelphia. He smiled thinly at me. Ah, yes. But that was my time away, my busy time. This time apart, we can think. I thought then, too.
You had time.
Yes. I said, not wanting to consider what he might think about while I was gone. But then we pulled up to the terminal, and there was all the distraction of where to park, whether he should bother to park, whether he should even get out of the car. In the end, we double-parked, and he did get out to embrace me quickly, the lightest touch of his cool lips on my cheek. Then I walked away, into the terminal, out to the gate. As I flew north, I moved into what seemed like another country, an earlier time of year. You could still see snow lying under the trees in the woods, and the rest of the landscape was bleak and colourless except for the deep green of the pines. It was Susie who picked me up, holding a card against her chest with my name printed on it in big letters so I wouldn't miss her. "That was clever of you," I said, as we walked to the car. "I was wondering how I'd recognise you."
"Your mother suggested it," she said.
She was short and plump with dark curling hair. I was trying to remember what mother had told me about her. Math or physics? Something unusual for a woman, as I recalled it.
"I was wondering how I'd recognize you, too."
"How is she doing?" I asked.
"Oh, she's her same old self, really. In the hospital, I think they had her doped up, and she seemed, like, really old."
She had the same verbal tics as everyone else her age, whatever the speciality was. "She is really old."
"But, like, disoriented and irritable? That's what struck me, I think. How irritable she was. I never think of her as complaining. She's so, like, brave, don't you think?"
"I do," I said, realizing that this was true. In the car, I asked her to tell me about herself and the other students. She was chatty and seemingly comfortable. It was math, her field. But she'd hit a wall, she said, and didn't know if she could go on.
"It's like there are different sizes of the gift, you know what I mean? And I always thought I had this really huge gift. But now I look around me at all these math boys." She shook her head. "I don't think so."
I commiserated on having to think about starting over at her age, which was
24?
24, I said. When we came into the house, Mother's voice floated down the stairs.
"Yoo-hoo!"
"Yoo-hoo yourself," I yelled back, and Susie laughed. I went upstairs and dropped my bag outside Mother's door.
"Josie,"
she said, reaching her arms up. She was white everywhere, her skin, her turtleneck, her hair lying in a long, frizzing braid on one shoulder, except for the cinnamon-colored streaks in it, reminders of her long-ago dark auburn. She was dressed, the turtleneck under a cardigan, navy blue slacks with one leg rolled up over the cast. There was a big woolly sock on that. I leaned over and kissed her, smelling her talc and the light camphor odor from the heavy woolen blanket she still used. My bed would have them too, layered one over another, their very weight seeming to press you nightly into uncomfortable sleep. The girls had always complained of this on visits to her.
"I woke up with dents in me," Sadie had said.
Sadie. We talked for a few minutes, and then I went to change and unpack. When I finally sat down next to her bed and poured her some tea out of the pot I'd carried up on a tray, tea with lemon and arrowroot biscuits, the old familiar afternoon snack, she threw herself back dramatically into the pillows and said,
"It's my own damn fault. If only I'd been wearing sensible shoes."
"Why? What were you wearing? Manolo Blahniks?" She squinted at me from behind her bifocals.
"What's that?"
I was being silly. They're spike heels.
"Well, no," she smiled. "I had on those shoes I wore to Boston."
"Mother, they don't come more sensible than that."
"Well, but, I mean, I should have had on flat heels. I should have had rubber soles."
"Oh, snow tires," she laughed.
"More or less. It was vanity. And now I pay the price."
I laughed too.
Well, sooner or later we all pay the price, I guess.
But this is serious, you know.
You'll be fine in no time, I said dismissively. Her doctor had assured me this would be the case.
No, don't say that. I mean, I know I will this time, but it's the beginning.
It's the beginning of exactly nothing, I said.
Josie, my girl, it's the beginning of the end, and you know it. Slow or fast, it doesn't matter from here on out. It is the beginning.
She raised a hand against my protest.
And don't you pretend it isn't the first thing you thought of.
Mother, it's not.
Well, the second or third thing, then.
I set my cup down. Listen, lady, I said, I'll admit it. The thought occurred way down the list. But the moment I talked to the doctor, I stopped thinking about it altogether. This was almost true. You're going to be fine. He said so. I know it. Susie knows it. She huffed, a little sharp exhalation from her lips. Then she took a neat bite from her cookie. When she swallowed, she'd looked at me.
It's not that I'm afraid. I want you to know that. The only thing I worry about is dementia. And leaving home. I want to die at home. Now that is premature.
She ignored me.
I want you to know something, she said. I've signed one of those living wills. I know it's not binding, but I've signed it. Fred has it. He's the executor.
She pronounced it murderously. Executor.
I'll have the lawyer send a copy to you, too. But I wanted you to hear it from my lips as well. I want to stay at home.
She smacked the bedclothes with her hand on the beat.
I'd rather die sooner at home than later in a hospital. Those 2 nights were plenty enough for me, thank you. It was like being already dead. It was more like hell than anything I've ever lived through.
This was her mood then. When I talked to Daniel on the phone that night, I called it cheerful morbidity and made him smile. I could hear it in his voice when he spoke again. The days at my mother's house passed slowly, mindlessly, and I was relieved, even happy in a way, for that. We played checkers, Mother and I, and gin rummy. She beat me because, as she said in disgust, I didn't even try to remember what cards had already been discarded. The first few days, I had her walking up and down the long upstairs hall for even lengthier intervals. The second afternoon, I persuaded her to come downstairs, sitting down first at the top and sliding the crutches along with her. I took a few steps below her, moving backward as she descended, encouraging her progress, but I didn't help. After she'd struggled to get herself up, to get her crutches tucked under her armpits again, she said,
"Good thing they built these old houses with sturdy mill posts,"
and burst into tears. I tried to do a chore or two for her each day. I went shopping and made her about a week's worth of dinners, which I froze. I bought her a small backpack to haul things around in. She wore it reversed, hanging off her front, so she could get at it more easily. I did several big loads of laundry, since it seemed it would be a while before she could easily manage the trip to the basement carrying anything. I returned her library books and got her new ones. I went to the store and bought a jigsaw puzzle, and we started it on a card table I set up in front of the fireplace. It was pleasant, the idle, pointless, unfreighted conversation about colour and shape, about who was working on edge pieces, about where our separate clusters of pieces might fit together. One day, late in the week, as we were working on it, seemingly out of the blue, she said,
"I feel bad, taking you away from Daniel for so long."
"It's not very long, Mother."
"Still, it disrupts your life."
I smiled.
"We've been having a disrupted life," I said.
She looked up sharply. "It's been a hard time between us. Actually, it's not a bad time to be apart for a while."
"Well, hard times happen, Josie."
She was watching me now. "I know," I said.
"Do you? I used to worry that you didn't know that. That's what made you so..."
So what?
So restless, I guess. Like the time you ran away from that hapless Ted.
But you see, Mom, it all worked out for the best.
She sighed testily. I suppose so.
We fell silent again. The puzzle was a Monet haystack. The pieces were covered with blurry pastel brushstrokes.
Suddenly she said, "You know, Josie, there's something I've always meant to tell you. And it's bothered me that I didn't. I don't know that it makes any difference now, but I feel I should. I feel I ought to do those things I have neglected to do."
I raised my hand to ward it off. I suppose whatever intimacy it was going to be, I didn't want it. I wanted everything I knew about my mother to stay the same.
"No, now you listen to me. Sit still and listen."
And abruptly, we were not working on the puzzle. I looked at her. Her lips were pressed against each other firmly, resolve. And then she began.
"It's about your father, you know, your father and I, well, he was married once before he and I were married."
I looked away sharply. I was shocked. Had she imagined, how could she have imagined that I'd never known? It was true that we'd never spoken of it, but there was so much we'd never spoken of. Sex, childbirth, anger, love, sorrow. All these were encoded or contained in the language of everyday life, or simply never referred to in our family. I thought I was going to laugh, in relief, I suppose. This was all there was. This was the most terrible secret in my mother's life, the one she had to tell before she died.
How wonderful.
How extraordinary.
"His first wife died," she was saying solemnly. "I'd known him for some years by then, working for him, don't you know? She died awfully slowly. She was ill for years. She was ill, they didn't know it, but she was ill even before they were married. So right from the start, they were coping with that. By the end, her whole insides were eaten up, more or less." She gestured at her own belly. "I suppose that's some of it. You just didn't talk about cancer in those days. That made it kind of private. And then I think your father and I were, I suppose I'd have to say, ashamed. It seems odd now from this great distance that we would be. But we were happy together even before she died, if you know what I mean."
I nodded quickly.
"And that shamed us. We really didn't speak of it, even to each other. How happy we were, at her expense. We just, well, what we felt, I suppose, was that we couldn't help ourselves. I know I couldn't. I just, well, I fell in love with him. He was so shy, don't you know? He asked for so little for himself that it broke my heart, really. I just began to do the things for him that a wife would do. I'd pack him lunches when he went botanizing. Sometimes I'd even go along. It was lovely."
Her face had softened. "I'd take a book and sit on a blanket and read. And off your father would go and come back every now and then to show me what he'd found." I thought of Daniel and me in the boat.
"It sounds lovely," I said. "But that early happiness, well, it cost us something later. There were things we never..." She sat straighter.
"We paid a price," she said firmly. "Nothing is free, is it?" Her voice was stronger now. She smiled at me, a little vaguely.
"Well, he told Freddie, and I was to tell you, but you were littler, and the time never seemed just right. And then, so suddenly, he was gone. And you were so devoted to him, it seemed a terrible thing to me to do anything that might hurt his memory."
I was wondering again that she could have thought I didn't know this, especially after Fred was told. Did she not understand the hard currency of painful knowledge that siblings paid each other off in? Did she not understand how everything slowly or quickly rises to the surface in family life?
Well, that's my secret, she said. She was waiting for my response.
And it's not so awful, is it?
I hope not, dear.
No, it isn't.
It doesn't change anything, does it? I shook my head. I hope you can think of your father and me.
Well, we're the same, aren't we?
I reached out and touched her hand. Mother, of course. She let my hand rest on hers a moment.
What was terrible, I suppose, was the not telling it.
It didn't hurt me, Mother.
Well, so you say, Josie. But you don't really know now, do you?
No, but I suppose it's part of who I am by now. Of course, I didn't mean the not knowing, since I had known. I meant the not speaking, the keeping of the secret. And I meant what the secret itself gave to me so young. The seductive sense of another self, another possibility.
And what if we had been utterly open, made jokes about the first wife? What if we'd been that kind of family? Well, I would have been different, surely, but not because I knew the secret. For it wasn't the secret that wasn't a secret anyway, that led to the austerity in our lives. It was the austerity that led to the secret. And what I had been marked by, probably most of all, was the austerity. It had made secrets in my life, too, or silences, anyway, that became secrets, that became lies. I thought of Dana, who loved what she thought of as my dignity, and she had never known my real name. I thought of my daughters, who found me elusive, in some sense, I suppose, unknowable, of Sadie, who couldn't believe in me now, of my husband, whom I betrayed, who seemed to have been willing to think, if only briefly, that I was capable of even worse than that. He was so cut off from me now that I'd wondered if we shouldn't end our marriage. I ought to ask her a question or two, I realized. Did you know her? I asked after a moment, Daddy's wife.
Early on, I met her a few times, but she was very ill by then, not herself.
Idly, she picked up a puzzle piece and moved it around in the air over the clumps of attached pieces she was working on.
Oh, well, she said. Maybe by then being ill was what being herself meant. I don't know. All I know is your father felt he'd lost her. He'd lost her already years before she died.
Then she said, look here, isn't this something that goes with your stuff over there? And held the piece out to me. That night, I sat up by the fire after my mother had gone to bed. The students were drifting in and out of the kitchen, getting late-night snacks and drinks, coming in to talk to me briefly, and it struck me with some amusement that my mother was, in a way, living the life I'd run away for so many years ago, unencumbered, free, in an easy, relaxed household, among other unencumbered, free people. I called up her face, her iron blue eyes, her age-freckled skin with the finest of lines distributed evenly on it everywhere, like a delicate mesh laid over her features. I marveled again at her innocent secret, at her impulse to tell it. After all these years, I thought. And then heard Detective Ryan's pleased voice talking about Eli, about killers who've gone free.
They have to tell,
he'd said. Well, apparently so. But why? What is it that comes from the telling? Some of it must be relief, of course. A secret weighs on us. A terrible secret weighs with a terrible weight. I thought about Eli and saw him again in the library, the raised hand, the shy smile, which I had read as corrupt and corrupting, as an attempt to include me somehow in his guilt. But what was it he had said when I asked him why he had told, why he had chosen me?
I need a kind of forgiveness from you.
It was what Mother had needed. Why not Eli? So maybe I misunderstood him that day in the library. Maybe he was saying only please through the dancing slice of light, and in return he saw me saying only no. Maybe my turning away from him then is what hardened him, what made it possible for him to defend himself to the police by accusing me. Because I had judged him, refused him. Because he no longer saw me as the generous, mature person he'd understood me to be. I thought of my mother asking me, "We're the same, aren't we?" It hasn't changed us in your eyes to know this. And the comfort she seemed to take in knowing that it hadn't. I thought of my blurting out to Daniel what I'd done, my hope that he could somehow love me still. It seems we need someone to know us as we are, with all we have done, and forgive us. We need to tell. We need to be whole in someone's sight. Know this about me and yet love me, please. But it's so much to ask of other people, too much. Daniel makes it easier on those around him. God is the one he asks to know him as he is, to see him whole and love him still. But for us others, it seems there must be a person to redeem us to ourselves. It isn't enough, apparently, to know oneself, to forgive oneself in secret. I crushed the fire into embers and replaced the screen. And as I mounted the stairs and undressed, as I slid under the cold, heavy covers, "Flat as a pancake till morning," my mother used to say, I felt, I think for the first time, a kind of pity for Eli Mayhew. I spent the afternoon before I left pulling the sodden leaf mulch off Mother's flower beds in the front yard. I worried that it was too early, that there might still be a frost, but she was firm.
"Oh, it's always too early, no matter when you do it. They're so pale and puny. Too early and too late at the same time. It could get cold again, but on the other hand, it's not good for them to grow very long in the dark. One of those chores, you just hold your nose and do it and hope it comes out all right. Anyway," she said, "I always do it by tax time, and that's nearly upon us now."
It was the first slightly warm day we'd had, and I sat in the pale sunlight on the damp ground. The plants were up, she was right, poking their snub noses out of the wet dirt, often having pierced the leaves, so that I had to pull each one off carefully or risk splitting their fragile tips. They were white and looked oddly naked, their secret growing suddenly exposed like this. They seemed at first to shrink and recoil, to dry up a little in the light and air. But even as I worked, they were greening slightly too. The sunlight bore down on my back and warmed me, for my legs and bottom were cool and damp. I took off my mother's gardening gloves after the first few minutes. They made it hard to do the delicate work around the shoots. I shifted from side to side, and then up to my knees as my hips started to ache. But I loved it also. I felt, for the first time, I think, since I'd heard Eli's name, since I'd met him again, content to be doing what I was doing. I felt innocently useful. That night I had a dream. Something in it startled me, and I woke myself, making a small noise, jumping under the heavy layers of blanket. It came to me that it had been about Daniel, though I couldn't remember what was happening. But I had reached out to touch him just before I woke, and I could still feel it, Daniel's cool cheek under my fingertips. How real it was, I thought. And then I recalled the dogs in sleep, the way they suckled and ran and tore at other animals. So real their dream life was to them. Did they know the difference when they woke? I wondered. Or were they like demented people who count as experience what they've merely dreamed? As I lay there, I realized I was doing just that. Because I was happy, happy with just my dream of Daniel, the vague, sleeping memory of him. I brought him to life, lying in the dark in my mother's house. I'd felt him and touched him. He'd come back to me. And for that moment, in my half-sleeping, half-waking state, the joy that gave me felt like enough. Once the plane had landed at Logan, and we'd slowly filed off, I headed downstairs along with the rest of our troop toward the baggage claim area, dragging my rolling bag behind me. Ahead of me, on the escalator, a little boy of about 4 was trying to tell knock-knock jokes to his mother, getting them wrong every time, jumping from "who's there" directly to the punchline. She laughed politely at each one, though, which was enough for him.
"That was a good one," he'd say. "Wasn't it, Mom? That was a good one."
I crossed the wide stone floor downstairs to the wall of windows and revolving doors. Outside, I could see the cars parked and double-parked, waiting. And then I saw our car. Leaning against it with his back against the driver's side, turned away from me, was Daniel. I negotiated my bag into the revolving door and made it through. The noise outside was deafening, a plane starting its takeoff. The dogs were in the car. I could see them barking and jumping wildly around, perhaps in response to all the noise, perhaps at the people passing by, too close to their territory. Daniel was turned almost in profile to me, watching a group of travelers boarding a bus pulled up to the middle island of the drive-through area. The scream of the plane was so intense now that he didn't hear me come up next to him. He didn't sense me standing there. Without asking myself whether I should, whether I could, I lifted my hand to his face and touched it to the flat of his cheek. He startled and turned to me. After the slightest pause, his arms rose in what seemed a nearly automatic response to embrace me. We pressed together, hesitantly at first. Then I felt him suddenly grip me hard, Daniel, and pull me fiercely against him. His hands slid up and down my back. I felt his tense strength. The moment went on and on for me, dizzying in its timelessness. I was drinking in with my body the feel of his, and I was breathless with relief, with the sweet familiarity of our touch. "This," I thought, holding him, "this, here." Slowly, my breathing evened. But before we stepped apart again, I made myself register consciously the expression that had passed for a moment over his face as he moved forward to hold me. A sadness, a visible regret. At what? At this giving over, I suppose. This capitulation to me. To us. And I haven't forgotten. I think of it often. And I find a kind of tender sorrow rising in me for him. For the distance he had to cross. The place he'd had to come from to yield to me. For his giving up some hardness in himself, maybe a hardness that had surprised him or pleased him in a way, to be what I knew again, to be the one who had to forgive me. So we resume it, slowly picking up the ongoing conversation that was our life together. We talk. We talk, and the words make our silences easier. They're the current that runs under them. We make love, too, a little shyly at first, as though there were something embarrassing or shameful about starting again after not having done it in so long. And there come more and more those other moments of touching, the ones I have most deeply yearned for, I realize. Daniel's hand resting on my shoulder as he looks over it to see what I'm doing, what I'm making for dinner. On my arm, here, I'll carry that. On my thigh, a claim, an assertion. You're back. I'm back. We're home again. I know you. Summer comes, and we walk again at night, trailing the dogs on the worn paths. In the cotton dark, the words seem easeful, seem like the spoken version of our bodies bumping or touching, all part of the same remaking of what it means to be together, to touch each other, to love. Still, there are things that startle me, new things, some small, barely worth noticing, perhaps. I'm talking at the dinner table one night, happy to be back in our old pattern, maybe going on too long, and I see that he has gone away, that his face has closed in and clouded somehow. And because I can't bear to ask, to be told what's wrong, I chatter on, ignoring it, until he comes back, until the moment of darkness has passed. Others, more dramatic, leaving late for work, I'm sliding behind the steering wheel of my car when I notice Daniel. He's deep in the barn in shadow, just stepping out of his office to come to the house. He's seen me in the car, and he's stopped there, waiting. He doesn't realize I've seen him. He doesn't want me to see him. Maybe he's been thinking about all of it again, and he doesn't want to have to talk to me, to have to be loving. Maybe he just wants to hold on to something he's been thinking about, working on. At any rate, he stands still, barely visible, a pale ghost in the shadows, and he waits for me to be gone. So I go, because this is my task as I see it, and I'm trying to learn it well. I'm trying to accept the changes I made when I didn't intend to. I'm trying to allow for this ordinary distance between us, to let him not want me sometimes, sometimes not to need him, so that when it comes, I can love it more, the approach, the turning back to what we do want most in each other, what we do need. I see Eli around town every now and then. Eli alone or together with Jean. Once, they were jogging by the side of the road as I was driving by. This was early in the summer, one of those long June evenings, when the sun sits forever at the earth's edge, and day goes on and on in its warm last light. I didn't recognize them at first. They were just silhouettes ahead of me, a man and a woman, not young, but strong, fit, in good shape, their stride perfectly matched, the legs lean and muscled. Closer, I saw they were my age, and I envied them their bodies, the nice high kick behind each stroke. And then, just before I pulled abreast of them, I knew who they were, and I turned my face away. In the rear-view mirror, the sun was full upon them. They were like costumed twins in their bright running clothes, their skin daubed orange in the light, their matching short hair silvered. I watched them grow smaller and smaller on the roadside. They hadn't noticed me. I saw him by himself once at the hardware store. I was bent over a bin counting out galvanized nails, and I looked up and there he was, in shirt sleeves and old khakis, his hair grown out a little, standing at the counter, asking about paints, oil versus latex. I turned and went into another aisle until he'd left. But it reminded me of something. I stopped in at the library on my way home, though Daniel was waiting for those nails. I went to the computer room and called up again the newspaper image of all of us leaving the police station after Dana's death. There we were, young and grief-stricken and angry. Eli and I were the only ones not wearing coats. He walked by our house on the 4th of July, as did half the town, following the parade. I'd been sitting on the front steps with Shorty, the door open behind me. When I saw Eli and Jean, I stepped back into the darkness of the front hall to wait until they'd passed. Until that part of the parade, the antique cars, the firemen throwing candy to the avid children, had gone by. They were with another couple I've seen around town a bit but don't know. They were talking and laughing. Jean and the woman carrying mugs of coffee as they walked along in the dappled sunlight under the old, wide trees. They're making friends then, settling in. My wish that they move away will, apparently, not be granted. But perhaps this is all to the good. Perhaps it's best to live with the possibility that around any corner at any time may come the person who reminds you of your own capacity to surprise yourself, to put at risk everything that's dear to you, who reminds you of the distances we have to bridge to begin to know anything about one another, who reminds you that what seems to be, even about yourself, may not be, that like him, you need to be forgiven. I tell myself it's all to the good anyway. Still, when I see him, I always turn away as if I don't recognize him, as if I don't know who he is. And so far, he does too. That is the end of While I Was Gone. It was written by Sue Miller and read by Buffy Davis. This has been an ISIS Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.